This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's Wednesday, May 10th, and a former U.S. president is liable for sexual abuse. You start here. In a landmark decision of the Me Too era, a jury sides with E. Jean Carroll over Donald Trump.
A former president of the United States labeled a sexual abuser.
What does this mean for him, his political future, and the many other women who have made similar allegations? Those weren't criminal charges, but these charges against a congressman are.
The Department of Justice plays to win every time.
George Santos has now been charged by the feds, but for what? And was the last decade of guidance a decade too late?
If you don't screen this population, women's lives will be affected.
A new model for mammograms may be on the way. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When Donald Trump became president, the phrase Me Too was not yet considered a hashtag. That became a worldwide phenomenon in 2017, after Harvey Weinstein became persona non grata, after Trump's inauguration, and a full year after his Access Hollywood tape had become public. And over and over since then in the Me Too era, women have recounted being sexually harassed or assaulted, deciding to put the incident behind them only to see their abusers promoted, praised, and politically elevated. They become omnipresent, almost impossible to ignore. And it's at this moment, many women say, that they feel the need to come forward, even years later. That's what E. Jean Carroll says happened to her, that a well-known businessman named Donald Trump once raped her in a department store dressing room and went on to become the most famous man on the planet. There was never a criminal trial, the statute of limitations had passed, but when Trump called E. Jean Carroll a liar, she sued him. And yesterday, in one of the most damning verdicts against a president in American history, a jury concluded that Donald Trump is lying, that they believe his accuser. ABC senior investigative correspondent Aaron Katursky is at the courthouse where this all happened yesterday. Aaron, this was a quick verdict, right? What did the jury find?
The jury deliberated less than 3 hours to reach what has to be considered a stunning verdict, Brad. A former president of the United States labeled a sexual abuser. The jury's decision did not find that Trump raped Carroll as she had claimed, but did find that he had sexually abused her in a department store dressing room in the 1990s.
E. Jean Carroll telling the court, quote, "I am here because Donald Trump raped me," the former Advice columnist adding, "When I wrote about it, he said it didn't happen. He lied and shattered my reputation."
And they also held him liable for defaming her by calling her story a con job, a hoax and a lie, and saying she was not my type.
"The only difference between me and other people is I'm honest. She's not my type."
"I take it the three women you've married are all your type."
"Yeah."
In fact, the jury listened to Trump's deposition in which he said...
"You're saying Marla's in this photo?"
"That's Marla, yeah. That's my wife."
"Which woman are you pointing to?"
"No.
Here.
Carol."
"Oh, is that?"
"The person you just pointed to was E. Jean Carroll."
"Who is that? Who is this?"
And that, her attorney said, proved that Carroll was exactly Donald Trump's type. And so they awarded Carroll $5 million total in damages for battery and defamation.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's important to understand here that this was a civil trial, not a criminal trial. So that's why we're not using words like guilty and innocent. Rather, he's liable for this. I mean, what are the key differences in terms of how that plays out in a courtroom?
Well, there's no consequence beyond money for former President Trump, maybe also reputation, now that the jury has labeled him a sexual abuser. But, right. Brad, this is the first time that former President Trump has been held to account for any of the, what, two dozen or so sexual misconduct allegations that he's faced in a number of years. And E. Jean Carroll says that she filed her lawsuit to clear her name and get her life back. She says the world finally knows the truth. And she called the verdict here a victory, not just for her, but for all women who have suffered because they have not been believed.
And you mentioned that there have been so many accusations against the former president. I mean, did that come into it at all? Like these allegations or these words about women in the past, or did the jury just have to kind of stick to what was being said by E. Jean Carroll herself?
Not every past accuser, but two of them did testify as witnesses to help the plaintiff try to show a pattern of alleged behavior that Trump, of course, denied.
I would like to express my support for E. Jean Carroll with her suit against Trump. Her story rings true to me.
Jessica Leeds testified to the jury that Trump assaulted her on an airplane in 1979. And Natasha Stoynoff, a former writer for People magazine, told the jury that she was working on a profile of Donald and Melania Trump for their first wedding anniversary for the magazine when Trump took her into a room at Mar-a-Lago and sexually assaulted her.
And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab him by the I can do anything.
And the plaintiff's side, E. Jean Carroll's attorney, said this was part of a pattern of behavior that Trump himself described to Billy Bush in the now infamous Access Hollywood tape, when he said stars like him can get away with kissing and grabbing women without their consent.
Although I remember when E. Jean Carroll, who, by the way, like noted columnist, like this is a very public person, public persona out there. People knew who she was well before this. And then she put these allegations out there in 2019. And there were so many details to go over and to pick apart. I guess I'm wondering, like, did her side have to corroborate each and every one of these? Or was this not quite about all of that because of the format?
Since this was not a criminal trial, Brad, the standard was not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The standard to find battery was preponderance of the evidence. So it's, you know, 51%, if you think of it that way. Mm. And on that score, all her attorneys had to do was convince the jury that E. Jean Carroll was telling the truth. Not that there weren't inconsistencies. There were plenty of inconsistencies, and the defense tried to discredit every aspect of Carroll's testimony and suggest to the jury that Carroll didn't act like a rape victim. She kept the dress she wore. She kept shopping at Bergdorf's even after the fact. She never went to the police. She didn't scream. She watched The Apprentice and found it to be a very good show. And the plaintiff's side presented a psychologist during the course of the trial to explain why Carroll, as a trauma victim, may have behaved in certain ways and not behaved in other ways. And it seems, by nature of the verdict, that the jury believed that they understood why, as the plaintiff's attorney said, Carroll was not what the defense considered to be the perfect rape victim.
Hey, Trump never testified in court, right? Like, he didn't even show up. The plaintiff's side played a recorded deposition. But did that lack of physical presence affect his chances here?
His attorney said there was no reason for him to show up because he didn't have to say anything beyond he didn't do it.
This was a circus atmosphere, and having him be here would be more of a circus.
Joe Tacopina, the defense attorney, said that what would he have asked Trump? Where were you on an unspecified date 27 or 28 years ago? He said because E. Jean Carroll could not pinpoint an exact date when the alleged rape occurred, that there was nothing to ask him because he couldn't ever establish an alibi. But it clearly was something that the plaintiff's side seized on. In closing arguments, one of Carroll's attorneys said Trump never came here to look you, the jury, in the eye and say he didn't do it.
Yeah, and in fact, Trump put out a statement on his social media platform, Truth Social, saying, I have no idea who this woman is. This verdict is a disgrace, he said. The plaintiff's attorneys, though, felt like they demonstrated he knew exactly who she was. He'd been around her before, and apparently the jury went with them. He will, of course, appeal. Aaron Katursky, there in Manhattan, after this verdict, it really has the power to continue to shape Trump's legacy. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Brad.
Meanwhile, there's another major headline in Republican politics this morning. New York Congressman George Santos, the lawmaker who was caught lying about a host of biographical bullet points, is being indicted by federal prosecutors. So let's quickly pivot to Sarah Isger, GOP strategist and former DOJ spokeswoman. She's now an ABC News contributor. And Sarah, we'll talk about Trump in a second. Let's start with the Santos news. We still don't actually know what he's charged with. Like, the details are under seal until an appearance, I think, later today. Do you have a sense of what he could be charged with?
Some of the problem that we have is that there have been so many stories coming out about George Santos that it's a little hard to decide which of all of those the Department of Justice decided to pursue. I think obviously we're looking at fraud, but which fraud that they actually thought that they found sort of that overwhelming evidence for? Because remember, the Department of Justice doesn't bring charges unless it is very, very sure not only that you committed the crime, but that they can win at trial. They don't bring cases to lose. It's part of what makes a federal indictment so scary, is that the Department of Justice plays to win every time. So look, I think it's a good bet that we're looking at fraud. What specific issue that raised that fraud? Yet to be seen. Obviously, it would have to be federal. We could be looking at, for instance, campaign finance violations. And it's probably worth noting, by the way, this would not be unusual for the Department of Justice. During my time at DOJ under Attorney General Sessions, we indicted two sitting congressmen, both Republicans, by the way. One was for campaign finance violations. One was for insider trading issues. And just to prove the point, the DOJ plays to win. Both ended up pleading guilty rather than even going to trial.
Also, you'd think just huge stakes for this very, very small majority in the House and Congress. Let's turn to the Trump news, Sarah, for political analysis, because let's remember, it's not just Trump's financial liability that's the most important thing here. It's not even just his legacy. He's a current politician. Like, he is currently the front runner in the polls to face President Biden in the election. And yet you got a jury essentially saying the leading GOP front runner is a sexual assailant. I mean, let that sink in. This wasn't a criminal trial. He's not the current president. But does this change the race for the GOP nomination in your world?
Yeah, but not the way you think. Because what this is going to cause is for a lot of those other candidates, all of them are going to get asked about this. None of them have shown an interest in wanting to alienate Trump or his voters. And so instead, what you're going to see is all those candidates almost have to back off even more.
Oh, and almost defend him, the guy they're running against.
Exactly. Huh. And for every day that they don't attack Donald Trump, don't show any distinction between why they're running against him, Donald Trump is picking up momentum. And we are seeing that in the polls. It'll be interesting if a Chris Christie gets in the race. Mike Pence isn't in the race yet. Those are candidates who have maybe shown some interest in pushing back. But until we see that from those guys, it affects the race. It actually puts the other candidates at a disadvantage.
Right, but that's my question. If none of this changes anything, and he's currently in the lead in the polls, knowing all this, and you're saying, like, none of this really makes a difference, should we just start calling him the presumptive GOP nominee and move on? Like, is that what you're saying? He's basically won this?
Look, it's always too early to say it's done because something could change. But right. If you're asking whether this changes anything, I think it makes him a stronger frontrunner for the Republican nomination at this point.
With that in mind, considering that Trump's legal future is as in flux as his political future over the next year and a half, are there other cases that you think loom larger in your eyes, or is everything kind of like this? If he gets found guilty of something, or if he gets found liable for something, this is essentially how it's going to shake out for all these things. They're all equal.
Let me answer that this way. If I were one of Trump's Republican opponents, I would have wanted these cases in a very different order. Mm. I certainly would not have wanted the New York indictment first. That would have been my lowest choice to have go first, because it's the one that Trump's defense is the strongest in. I think it's the weakest legal case.
The Stormy Daniels thing.
This one might have been second, frankly, because it's civil, because the allegations that are at the core of it, as you talked about, are so old. The Georgia case has always been, I think, the one where Trump has the most legal jeopardy. This is the one about him calling Georgia officials, find me the 11,800 votes. It's a Georgia state criminal case. We're expecting to see some movement on that, I assume an indictment, coming this summer. If that had been the first case, I think we might be having a different conversation. Because it's going to be kind of clumped in the middle of all of this, and remember, the Department of Justice special counsel still has three outstanding investigations. I don't expect those to wrap by this summer. I think Georgia could get lost in the noise, slash, it gets sort of baked in of like, yep, Trump has legal problems. No, at this point, because I'm not expecting us to see new evidence in any of these cases.
Some really clear-eyed analysis there. All right, Sarah Isger, thank you so much.
You bet.
Next up on Start Here, how young is too young to worry about breast cancer, a major potential change after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Of all the diseases that can conceivably kill you, breast cancer is among the most common. Every year, 250,000 Americans are diagnosed with breast cancer. More than 40,000 people die. 1 in 8 women are expected to get an invasive breast cancer at some point in their lives. And so yesterday, it was a big deal when an influential task force took a step toward recommending lowering the age at which women should start getting screened. Let's bring in our chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, who, by the way, specializes in women's health. And Dr. Ashton, who is this group and what is the new guidance?
Okay, Brad. So first, let me give you some historic perspective. The group is the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force group. They are one very influential medical group made up a lot of different specialists, including nurses, and they make recommendations based on available evidence and data. And insurance companies and Medicare usually follow their recommendations. For some history here, let me take you back to 2010. This same group, this same U.S. Preventive Service Task Force group, did the exact opposite. They took screening age for average woman for breast cancer that used to be 40, they moved it to 50. There was huge uproar in the medical community amongst lay people alike saying, if you don't screen this population, women's lives will be affected. We will see more aggressive cancers, more later stage diagnosed cancers, and that is not good. Now, 14 years later, Brad, guess what we're seeing? More cancers, and in particular, in certain groups of women, Black women, with more aggressive stage breast cancer. And so now they're using that newer data from the last 14 years and going back to screening the average risk woman starting at age 40, and then every other year.
Wow, that's so interesting that you have that sort of dramatic of a change, kind of like back to back. Is the switch back essentially because we're seeing more instances of breast cancer or more aggressive forms of breast cancer in the people who get it?
I think yes and yes, both of those things. And to be clear, back in 2010, they weren't saying that, you know, no mammograms helped save women's lives or detected breast cancer in this age group. They simply said that the risks outweighed the benefits. And again, there were a lot of people, a lot of groups that said, wait a minute, if one woman's life is saved, and you're talking about a young woman now, oftentimes with families, young children, if you can have a positive impact on this age group, that should be reason enough to continue screening. But a lot of that screening age was just dialed back. It was pushed back to age 50. And I want to bring your attention to one important word here, Brad. Average. The average risk woman, and this applies to cisgendered women, 80% of women are considered average risk until the day they get their breast cancer diagnosis. So when you start from that premise, you can see why this is such a loaded issue.
But and when we talk about risk outweighing the benefits, I mean, is there a reason to not get screened even yet? Like now when I hear this, I'd imagine there are 39-year-olds going, well, I should start getting screened all the time. I mean, why would getting screened ever be a bad thing?
Well, that's a critically important question. And that's a question that applies to all aspects of clinical medicine and even public health when you talk about screening. Because you have to balance risk versus benefit, right? And so mammogram, while it is the gold standard for diagnosing breast cancer, it is not a perfect test. So there are false positives as well as false negatives. It can miss early stage breast cancer, particularly in women with dense breasts. And it can see things that look suspicious that turn out not to be breast cancer that then warrant biopsies, in some cases surgery, which has...
Oh, and then you overcorrect.
That's right. And also we have to remember that while low dose, a mammogram does have some radiation in it. So you can't swing the pendulum to the other extreme and say, let's just screen everyone all the time as much as possible. More is not better.
I also wonder then if we're talking about average and not average. I mean, would people heed this advice differently based on fact? I mean, we're talking about age now, you know, change your risk based on your age. Would it also be adjusted for race? Like, like if we're seeing more Black women get more aggressive cancers at younger ages, it makes me wonder, like, should Black women be more concerned with getting tests younger? Should white women be less? I mean, how does that work?
I believe the answer to that question is yes, we should absolutely have in 2023 more individualized, targeted screening recommendations. This is not a one-size-fits-all situation. So what groups should be individualized? Yes, Black women, absolutely, because triple-negative breast cancer is more aggressive and tends to be diagnosed at a later stage in Black women. They face a 40% higher mortality rate after a breast cancer diagnosis than non-Black women. So Black women could be their own group. Women with a mutation could be their own group. Women with dense breasts could be their own group. Women of certain ages, in particular, women 75 years of age and older, are left kind of, you know, completely out of this equation. So a lot of people, myself included, are saying, look, it's modern times. Let's individualize this instead of just making a one-liner, simple blanket statement that leaves women, and in some cases, their healthcare providers, confused about exactly where they fit in.
Hey, last question, since there's a decade's worth of women now who might be looking at getting their first mammogram, I mean, what happens next? You call your doctor and you ask for a screening?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of dovetails into the importance of women getting well-woman checkups with either their OBGYN or their healthcare provider. And, you know, starting at age 40, and remember, this is without a family history of breast cancer. This is for the average woman. Say, I'd like to talk about breast cancer screening. How often should I do it? And which screening tests are right for me? A lot of doctors and healthcare providers are using mammogram with ultrasound because ultrasound can pick up early stage cancers that mammograms may miss in women with dense breasts. Why, Brad? Because I think you and I have talked about this before. Dense breast tissue looks white on mammogram. So does a breast tumor. So it's like finding a snowball in a snowstorm. So a lot of providers using ultrasound, but MRI is also an imaging option for high-risk women. And like, as I said, it's not one size fits all. So if women are hearing this and they're 40 at average risk, they should pick up the phone at their next visit with their healthcare provider and say, I heard the pendulum has swung once again, so let's talk breast cancer screening.
Really helpful information. All right, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, thank you so much.
You bet, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, in a book about death, should it mention that death was a murderer? One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing, she presented herself as an expert on grief. Prosecutors say she's an expert on causing grief.
What happened in your personal life?
So my husband passed away unexpectedly last year. So.
That's a mom named Corey Richens appearing on ABC's Salt Lake City affiliate a month ago, talking about her new children's book that was meant to help her kids cope with the passing of their dad.
Just because he's not present here with us physically, that doesn't mean his presence isn't here with us and he's doing these things with us.
Well, cut to this week, and Richens was placed under arrest for murdering him.
Charging documents alleging the 33-year-old called 911 in the middle of the night last March, saying she found her husband lying unresponsive and cold to the touch at the foot of their bed.
Authorities say she described fixing her husband a drink to celebrate a work achievement and then claimed she found him unconscious later. The medical examiner said he had a lethal dose of fentanyl in his system, and prosecutors claim Richens possessed GHB, the sleep drug commonly used in assaults. In the months after the death, Richens didn't flee or fly under the radar. She wrote a book.
I couldn't find anything that really, you know, suited them or helped them find comfort and peace, and so, you know, I was like, let's just write one.
At the same time, though, police were allegedly learning that just 3 weeks before his death, the husband had confided in a friend he thought his wife was trying to poison him. He thought one of his other drinks had been spiked on Valentine's Day. Now, the court documents claim she had also tried to make herself the sole beneficiary of his life insurance policy, which is not listed in the book as part of the grieving process. Wild ride that is, especially in an age where like self-help books and true crime seem to be what everyone wants to read and write. Like, this would be one way to bridge that gap, I guess. By the way, Corey Richens' attorney did not comment on these charges. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.